Many of us here in Iowa have received calls asking us who we support or how we feel about certain issues. But do you really know who is asking the questions and why? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we discuss the polls and the organizations behind them with Tom Jensen, Director of Public Policy Polling, and Ann Selzer of Selzer & Company. Before that, we'll find out who Iowa's top campaign donors are and discuss the laws that govern campaign financing in the state. My guests for that, Megan Tooker of the Legal Counsel for Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board, and political scientist Carrie Covington. Politics Wednesday starts right after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Wednesday here on the program. And we'll be splitting the program up into two halves, a little different than we normally do. We have given our political analysts a rest for this week. In the first half of the program, we want to talk about calls that perhaps you or online requests that you have asked, have received. Who will you support? How do you feel about a certain issue? We want to find out who's behind these questions and why. That's in the second half of our program. In the first half, we'll want to talk about Iowa's top campaign donors and what that money is being spent on, and discuss maybe some laws that govern campaign financing in the state. And to do that, we've invited Megan Tooker. She is Executive Director of the Legal Counsel for Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board in our Des Moines studio. Hi, Megan.
Hello.
Also joining us, Carrie Covington, University of Iowa Political Science Professor. Professor Covington joining us by phone. Hello to you, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. Talk, first of all, about who are Iowa's biggest donors, and maybe you can tell us a little bit of a background on them. Megan, is that a question for you?
I don't think I'm in the best position to say
the
backgrounds of those donors.
Okay. I'm looking at a list of those donors. We have mostly Republican donors in the top 10 list, Carrie Covington. But the number one donor, William C. Knapp, has given to Democrats. What can you say about the top donors?
Well, I'm not sure about the donors from Iowa, but I'm not clear. Are you speaking about donors to independent expenditure groups?
Well, I'm talking about Iowans who are giving to campaigns in these elections.
Right. There are limits on how much they can give to the campaigns. There's no limits on the amount that they can give to super PACs and 501c4s. So, for instance, you've got people giving millions of dollars to super PACs. So if we're talking about Iowans making large donations, then they're making contributions to these independent expenditure groups.
Sure.
Right. Okay.
I would just add that under Iowa law, individuals can give an unlimited amount of money to both their candidates and PACs.
Okay. That's to both campaigns and to super PACs.
Exactly.
Okay. Go on, Carrie.
Well, I don't know the particulars about Iowa donors, but if it follows national patterns, there are people with deep pockets on both the Democratic and Republican sides. And so both sides are receiving large amount donations to these independent expenditure groups.
Mm-hmm. What can we say about spending by the parties, Carrie Covington, when we look at the spending by the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, put them side by side, compare and contrast, what conclusions or what jumps out at you?
Mm-hmm. Well, generally speaking, the Republican Party has more money to spend. They spend it independent of the candidates, and they also spend it in jointly sponsored advertising. So my experience is mostly with the presidential races.
Mm-hmm.
So that while President Obama has a something of a lead in terms of his personal campaign raising, when you join it together with Republican Party joint fundraising activities, it kind of evens things out.
Okay. Megan Tooker, perhaps we can talk also a little bit about the independent organizations that have spent the money in this election. Do you have information on that?
Sure, sure. All right. Would you like to know who's...
Tell us about some of these organizations.
Sure. The Family Leader and the National Organization for Marriage are the two groups that are leading the charge against Justice Wiggins.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the Iowa Bar Association and Justice Not Politics are the two groups that are supporting not just Justice Wiggins, but judicial retention in general.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us in round figures how much money is being spent on that judicial retention campaign by each side?
Sure. On the pro-retention vote side, it's about $160,000 that's been reported to us so far, and it's about $230,000 that's been reported on behalf of Family Leader and National Organization for Marriage that are using those dollars against Justice Wiggins.
As a reminder to our listeners, Justice Wiggins, David Wiggins, one of the justices up for retention, who was part of that unanimous Iowa Supreme Court decision that paved the way for same-sex marriages in the state. How do you see that, Carrie Covington? Roughly equal, I guess, the ones against retention having a little bit more of an money edge there?
Yeah. Well, disparities in fundraising get more important as you move down ballot. Voters who are trying to make a decision about something near the top of the ballot probably have lots of sources of information being thrown at them, and so more money on one side or the other is going to be less important. But when you get down to the down ballot races, for instance, now you're starting to see some ads come on for state legislative races just starting in the last week, and this retention vote campaign has been going on now for a while. I think the different disparities in spending at those levels is going to be a lot more important because voters have less information coming in and fewer sources of information besides those ads. Mm-hmm. So a few $100,000 on a lower race is going to be much more important than on a top-of-the-ballot race.
Mm-hmm. We want to talk about those state races in just a moment, but back to judicial retention. What does the data tell you, Carrie Covington, about the impact of social issues within the state on campaign mm-hmm. donations and financing spending?
Yeah, well, when groups are trying to raise money from the electorate, certainly the hot-button issues are the ones that stimulate a response. And so if you can appeal to issues among conservatives like gay marriage or abortion, that's going to be likely to generate funding, just as on the liberal side, if you're talking about issues like free choice or pro-choice, you're more likely to stimulate donations. So these kind of wedge issues, these hot button issues, are the ones that groups are going to rely on in order to get people to give money.
Okay, talking about campaign financing, 1-866-780-9100. If you have a question, you can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook or tweet us at IPR Talk. Carrie, can you say that on a local level, money can be more influential?
Certainly.
So what does that mean about the outside spending coming in for Iowa's Senate and House races?
Right. If you look at state races, state House races, state Senate races, if groups from outside start pouring money into a campaign, they can put a lot more information out there. It usually is a negative ad. It's usually a tax on the opponent of the candidate they support, because negative ads tend to move people more than positive ads. And in these kinds of races, voters don't have a whole lot of information to go on. Beyond party, they're not likely to know too much more about the candidates. So if an outside group can come in and spend a few hundred thousands of dollars and paint a portrait of a candidate that's unflattering, that's going to have a significant impact, because there's not likely to be as much information that pushes back the other way mm-hmm. that would help them balance their view of that candidate.
Megan Tooker, can you give us any sort of picture on at the in-state versus out-of-state campaign money that's being spent in this election cycle?
Are you talking about the judicial retention or at the...
Generally speaking, in all races. I don't know if you calculate it that way or tell us what you can about how this 2012 race looks in terms of the money coming from outside the state versus the money that's generated and donated inside the state.
Sure. We don't analyze in-state versus out-of-state, but I can tell you that there's significant money coming from out-of-state, both at the legislative level as well as the judicial retention vote.
Mm-hmm. What haven't we touched on that you do measure there, Megan Tooker?
Well, one thing that I would just clarify with Professor Covington, in Iowa, the Democratic Party is actually outraising the Republican Party and outspending, which may distinguish between Iowa and the federal level.
Yeah, at the national level, the Republicans are up about $80 million.
Mm-hmm. Do you have numbers on that, Megan?
Yeah, I do. This year, the Democratic Party's raised a little over $5 million and has spent about $4.8 million, whereas the Republican Party has raised about $1.5 million and spent about $1.3
million. Hmm. As a purple state, do you find that how do you see that, Kerry Covington?
Well, it suggests that there's underlying support for the Democratic candidates. What you'd want to see is how that gets balanced out by the independent expenditure side. What I know at the national level is that conservative spending on independent expenditures is 2 to 3 times more than for conservatives than for liberals. So that if the same trend were true just in Iowa, which I don't know, then that would make it more of a wash in terms of the party difference.
We of course saw the Citizens United decision having an effect on our elections 2 years ago. That was a landmark U.S. Supreme Court case in which the court held that the First Amendment prohibits the government from restricting independent political expenditures by corporations and unions. Kerry Covington, how do you see that affecting the election here in Iowa?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to say about how it's going to affect Iowa uniquely from other places, but I'd really be interested also in getting Megan's feedback because, to me, Citizens United is important for reasons having to do with campaign expenditures that we're not really able to talk much about. There's a difference between super PACs, which are 527 groups, which have to report their donors who gave money and so on, and it's transparent because you know who the donors to those groups are. And groups that collect money under the IRS code 501c4, where the donors are kept confidential and you don't know who's giving the money. And what we know is that corporations are not putting money into the super PACs. There's very few corporate, very little of the money going into what we call super PACs is corporate money because corporations don't want the blowback or the backlash that comes from consumers if they're seen as being on the wrong side of an issue. So where Citizens United is really important is in terms of corporations being able to give unlimited amounts of money to groups that don't reveal who their donors are.
Mm-hmm.
And those would be groups like Americans for Prosperity and groups like that, where their expenditures, we don't know where that money comes from. We don't know who's putting that money up. We do know who's putting money up for Restore Our Future or Priorities USA, for instance.
Can you fill in any of the blanks there in what Kerry Covington just raised, Megan Tooker, with the Legal Counsel for Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board?
Sure. What Professor Covington was talking about is the rules for independent expenditures under federal law. In Iowa, it's a little bit different. Our independent expenditure statute only requires groups to report their source of funding if the donor gave money for the purpose of furthering the expenditure. So in Iowa, if you have individuals or groups that are giving money to certain organizations because they support their viewpoint in general, those donors don't have to be disclosed, whereas if they're giving money for a specific purpose, say the retention vote or specific candidates, then those donors do have to be disclosed. So we see a lot of independent expenditure reports filed with our office that don't list the source of funding.
Mm-hmm. Carrie Covington, is there any way to tell if political donations have had an effect on policy in Iowa in the past?
That's a good question. I suspect that the retention vote that kicked out Supreme Court justices last time around, state Supreme Court justices, was motivated or at least stimulated and supported by some contributions. I doubt that it was a strictly grassroots mm-hmm. event. That's the one I would look to as being potentially important. Maybe Megan could speak to how much money was spent on the retention vote in the last go-around.
Oh, yeah, Megan, can you do that? Do you have those numbers?
I don't have those figures. It was several hundred thousand dollars that were spent.
Okay, so we're in the same ballpark. When I sort of add the numbers you gave earlier, $500,000 total, something like that.
That sounds about right.
Okay. Iowa, of course, a battleground state, Carrie Covington, with our swing state status. Is the spending in Iowa, can you characterize that different because we are a swing state? Is it more influential, the spending, than a clear-cut blue or red state?
The question of influence is a difficult one to parse out. Certainly, we're having a lot more money spent in Iowa than any of the clear-cut states that are blue or red. Candidates look to maximize their leverage by putting the money where the outcome is in doubt. And so we're looking at states like Iowa and Colorado, Ohio, Florida, New Hampshire, Virginia, mm-hmm. North Carolina, a few of those states. Those are the states where the money is really pouring. Nevada would be another one. Those are the states where the money is really pouring in. And anybody who turns on the television knows that we are just saturated with ads for the presidential race. And now as we get closer to election day, you see more and more down ballot ads. Just in the last few days, I've seen many more state race advertising, most of it coming from candidates and parties, but there's also been some independent groups out there spending the money as well. And that's where I say you know who's spending the money when the candidate announces that he or she has approved of the ad. When you get a group with a name that you've never heard of making claims, it's a little bit hard to assess their reliability.
Mm-hmm. Megan Tooker, let's talk about the state races. What can you tell us there about spending on specific races, perhaps?
Sure. Do you have a specific race in mind?
Well, what about Michael Gronstahl versus his challenger, Al Regenberg?
Sure. Well, Senator Gronstahl's a unique candidate because of his ability to raise money as the majority leader. He reported to us that he started the year off with about $500,000 and took in another $500,000 and transferred the vast majority of that money to the Iowa Democratic Party. But, you know, still able to outspend Mr. Ringenberg quite heavily.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit, Carrie Covington, about transferring. When you get donations, the candidates share within their party the donations. Why would they do that? Why would they spread it out in certain cases and take it in others?
Yeah. Well, one of the important developments in legislative races has been the development of leadership PACs, where the leaders of the party in the legislature, a Speaker of the House, either at the national or state level, is able to draw in money in a way that your average rank and file member maybe cannot. And their race may not be in that much trouble. They're not really at risk. And so what they do then is they form a PAC, and then they can make contributions from their PAC to other candidates running for that legislature from their party who might be in more need of that money. And so mm-hmm. it's a way of collecting money from people who might not otherwise give by getting it given to a leader, a high-profile person, and then distributing it to candidates who have a lower profile and are having a harder time raising money. And it does two things. One is it helps members of your party get elected, and two, it creates a sense of indebtedness or loyalty to that party leader for helping when the election was being contested.
So as a donor, if I give to one political party or I give for one political candidate in a certain race, there is no guarantee that that money will be spent on that particular race?
Well, if you're giving it directly to the candidate for his or her campaign, they'll probably spend that money on their race. What I'm talking about are PACs that leaders set up outside of their own campaigns, political action committees, that solicit money donations. And then that PAC, which is run by the party leader, then distributes the money amongst his or her co-party candidates.
In Iowa, we're a little bit different. The candidates are not allowed to have leadership PACs. Instead, what they can do is transfer funds from their campaign accounts to their parties. They're not allowed to earmark where that money goes. So in other words, one candidate can't give to his party with instructions to give to another candidate. But we see with both parties, but particularly the Democrats, I think that's where a lot of the disparity lies with the between the Democrat and Republican Party is the candidates are transferring vast sums of money back to their parties that will then be spent in maybe more competitive races or races where the candidate, for whatever reason, is being outspent.
Before we have to go, we have a couple minutes left. I wanted to have you, Carrie Covington, comment on the Steve King and Christy Vilsack race. Mm-hmm. First of all, Megan, can you quickly give us any numbers in that particular race, the new 4th District of Iowa?
No, we don't have any jurisdiction over federal candidates.
That's okay. Carrie Covington, a lot of outside money we know being poured into the King-Vilsack race. What makes it such a big race nationally?
Well, Steve King has become noted as a sort of a high-profile conservative Tea Party favorite. He has, you know, made statements that draw attention and has been in a position, because of the nature of his district, to not really face any kind of a serious challenge from the Democratic Party. With the redistricting, the redistricting going along with losing a seat in the House, Steve King now has to represent a much larger area. Our redistricting is nonpartisan, and therefore it can't be drawn in a way that protects the incumbents. And so the way this district was drawn, it's put a lot of new people who were not King constituents in the past into King's district, and a lot of those people are not Republicans, are not conservative. A lot of them are Democrats. And so he now has to compete in a more competitive environment. And that attracted a high-profile Democratic challenger in Christy Vilsack. And so with Christy on the ballot, Christy Vilsack on the ballot, Iowa not having elected a woman before draws attention. Democrats being able to have a chance at beating Stephen King has an attraction. And so, yeah, you're going to draw a lot of outside money into this race.
Mm-hmm. And when we watch the national coverage on television or on NPR, that will be a race that will be watched undoubtedly with all the high-profile money going into it. And Steve King being the high-profile person he is, and Christy Vilsack being the former First Lady of Iowa.
Right. It's one that people will watch.
Thank you very much, Carrie Covington, University of Iowa political science professor. Megan Tooker, executive director of the Legal Counsel for Iowa Ethics and Campaign Disclosure Board. Thank you both for joining us this half hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, a short conversation with Iowa Public Radio Sandhya Dirks. He's just been at the Mississippi Valley Fairground in Davenport. President Obama holding a rally there. She'll also be covering the Romney rally later in Iowa today. That when we continue and a talk about polling. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Very nice to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. A different sort of Politics Wednesday today, looking at a couple of issues in this half hour. In just a moment, we're going to talk about polling because, of course, we as Iowans, many of us have been the target of polling, either online or through our phones in recent weeks and months. Perhaps you have an experience of being polled that stands out for some reason. You can share it with us this hour, or your questions about polling, or tell us how much polls influence you. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Before we do talk about polling, let's check in with Iowa Public Radio's Sandhya Dirks live. Sandhya is on her way back from Davenport, where she was at the Mississippi Valley Fairground in Davenport at a rally for President Obama, where he appeared. Hi, Sandhya.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. So tell us about the scene there at the fairground in Davenport.
Well, there were about 3,500 people there. A lot of people really excited. The enthusiasm was really strong. It was definitely a more raucous crowd, a more supportive crowd than ones I've seen before. And, you know, President Obama sort of, he talked for about half an hour, and he split it between really attacking Romney and then trying to sort of make the case that he has a plan and a vision forward. But this is less about changing minds, although that's always, I think, a bonus, and it's more about getting out the vote. You know, the message here constantly is vote, 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 do it now. So, for example, on the back of people's tickets, there was, you know, the location of their closest polling place, so they could leave the rally and go there. The get out the vote message is just, it's a really strong one that the whole campaign and the president was pushing.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like by what you're saying that the president's campaign is reacting to attacks from the Romney campaign, that they are simply attacking Romney and not offering anything for the next 4 years.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, he definitely did attack Romney. He used this new term he's coined, Romnesia, to refer to Romney's, what he calls Romney's flip-flopping, the way in which he says that he you know, is all things, wants to be all things to all people. And Obama talked about how he's solid, how you can go and look back at videotape of him from 20 years ago, 10 years ago, and it's the same stuff he says today. He wanted to present himself as somebody in opposition to Romney, as somebody who stands by his word. And he talked a lot about trust. And he said, look, you can trust me. You know who I am. I've been your president for 4 years. And he brandished about at the speech at the rally, he brandished about a folder, which he basically said was his plan. It was this booklet that he was carrying, and he directed people to go to the website. And that was a real attempt to take on this attack by the Romney campaign that he doesn't have a solid plan. So there he was, waving it for all to see and directing people to read about it and on their website.
Now, Governor Romney will be in Iowa this evening in Cedar Rapids. It's his first visit, I understand, to Cedar Rapids since before the caucuses. Can you give us, you'll be covering that as well for Iowa Public Radio. Can you give us a preview of the Romney visit in Cedar Rapids this evening?
It's sometimes hard to know what they're going to say, but they do tend to stick to their stump speeches. I would expect Romney to sort of do what the president did, to do some attacking, but at the same time also talk about the things that make him such a great candidate. He'll definitely talk about the economy. I mean, that will be his number one talking point. It always is, because it's really the number one talking point of voters.
Okay, Sandhya Dirks, thank you very much. We'll look forward to your report on All Things Considered, and I assume on Morning Edition tomorrow. Iowa Public Radio's Sandhya Dirks, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
And we want to talk about polling for the rest of the hour to help us do that, explain some of what's going on, what those calls have been about over the last few months, who they're from. Tom Jensen is with us, Director of Public Policy Polling. Joining us by phone, that's a U.S. polling firm based in North Carolina. I believe that's where you are, Tom Jensen. Hi.
Hey, good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Ann Selzer is with us, president of Selzer and Company in Iowa, public opinion research company based in Des Moines. Ann, you're in a Des Moines studio. Hi to you.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Let's talk, Tom, if I can turn to you first of all, because I see you have, you've been doing some new polling in Iowa, came out just a few days ago. What did that polling reveal?
Well, our most recent poll in Iowa found Barack Obama leading by just a single point, 49-48, definitely going to be one of the closest states in the country this year, in stark contrast to 2008. We found Obama leading 64-35 among early voters, those who had voted at least through Sunday, but Mitt Romney has a 54-42 lead with those who have yet to cast their ballots.
And what has been the latest polling your company has done?
Well, we were in the field in September, and we'll do toward the end of September. We have one more poll that will come out, be published in the newspaper the Sunday before the election.
Mm-hmm. So at this point in the campaign, and with 13 days left, what kind of polling is going on now? With this short time before the final day? The type of questions being asked, for instance?
Well, there's a lot of polling of a lot of different ilk, I guess, okay, going on. And so every morning my ritual is to get up and look at the polling aggregation websites where I can get a quick review of the most important polls that have happened that day. There are obviously things that are happening nationally. There are now some daily tracking polls that have kicked in. The Washington Post and ABC News is now publishing on a daily basis. Gallup has been publishing on a daily basis for a while. But trying to get a sentiment of the sense of the mood of the nation, you know, I think it's important to note that those national polls are sort of an indicator of mood, but not really predictor of how the election is going to go, because we don't elect our president with a national vote. We elect our president state by state by state. So the work that pollsters are doing in individual states, and PPP is among those that are very active in that, that's very helpful in getting a sense of where's the electoral college going to end up. And right now, while the national polls are showing this neck and neck, and some show Obama a point ahead, some show Romney a point ahead, some show a dead heat, the electoral college aggregation, to the extent that people divvy up all the states and kind of make a call, slightly more favorable toward Obama right now.
Mm-hmm. Tom Jensen, we've seen in the national polls and in some swing states since the debates, we've seen changes in that polling, Romney versus Obama. Iowa, does it reflect that national change, or is Iowa more of a consistent polling for each of the candidates?
Iowa really does reflect the change. Ann's poll, which I have a lot of faith in, had Obama up by, I believe, 4 points at the end of September. The week after that, we had Obama up by 7 points in Iowa. So it looks like a month ago at this time, that Obama was in decent shape in Iowa, not going to match his 10-point victory from 2008, but certainly in a position to win the state again. But after Mitt Romney's really strong performance in the first debate, a lot of voters began sort of reconsidering him. And what had been going on was that a lot of folks who weren't thrilled with the job Obama was doing were either undecided or still planning to vote for him because they didn't think Romney was really a good alternative. And what Romney's done over the course of this month is convince a lot of those folks that he is an acceptable alternative. So our last 2 points in Iowa now have each had the race within just 1 point. Obama was up a point on one, Romney was up a point on the other. And that is a big shift from what we saw a month ago. It's gone, in my opinion, from a lean Obama state to a pure toss-up.
Okay. Tom Jensen with us, Director of Public Policy Polling. And Ann Selzer is with us, president of Selzer and Company in Des Moines, public opinion research company based there. 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us your question, your comment, perhaps your experience. You've had an experience of being polled that stands out for some reason. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Marge, who is with us in Windsor Heights. Hi, Marge.
Hello. I have been called several times. And after the first couple of calls, when they got to it was usually about four questions. When they got to the last question, and if they found out I had done an absentee ballot, they asked me who I had voted for. I hung up because I don't like having people ask me who I voted for. And I don't know if you guys do that when people are leaving the polls or not, but I've just got to the point where if they say it's a poll, and certainly most of the names of the polls I cannot recognize, I don't know if they're Republican or Democrat, and if they're local or somewhere else, so I've started hanging up. Mm. So I'm no help to these people, I guess. But they're no help to me either.
Marge, thank you very much. Ann Selzer, tell us, if you're answering, if you were in Marge's position or anybody's position answering a phone, what do you see as the flags that tip off who is calling you and why?
Well, I don't know that I could give you a complete list of things to look for. There are people who are calling who are trying to do voter ID and figure out sort of what it is that, you know, whether you're somebody that they should court in terms of getting you to an early vote or whether you're somebody to watch on Election Day. And that kind of can sound like a poll and not be a poll. And
this is what we call push polling.
No, that's a different thing. A push poll is designed not to collect information, but to disseminate information. So it's going to not ask you a lot of demographic questions. It may ask you who you're voting for and then follow up immediately. Well, what if you heard this? What if you learned this? What if you could, would you change if you heard this? And the this tends to be very negative information by the opponent that they, that, that poll is targeting. They are not interested in doing anything strategic with that information, and they call massive numbers of people. A public opinion poll talks to a small number of people to reflect the large population of voters in order to get a sense of where that vote is going for. And I have sympathy for Marge because there's a lot of polling going on, and it is hard, and it can be, I would suspect, annoying. But we do count on voters to help us understand what's happening in an election by divulging who they're supporting. And whether she'd already voted or not, we would be asking that same question as to who does she support. So there's nothing in the fact that she'd already voted. There's nothing sinister about that. When we call, we do always say we're calling for the Iowa poll so that people know that's a local polling operation here. And it's if, to the extent that we get a bit more cooperation because of that, that's great. We train our interviewers to be courteous and kind. And we don't, at the beginning you said, Ben, that maybe you've been targeted. We like to not have you think that way. Okay. We like to have you think of a willingly cooperative respondent.
Okay, gotcha, Ann. Tom Jensen, I'd like to direct this Facebook comment from one of our listeners, Sarah, to you for a reaction. Sarah writes, I think there are two big differences this year. First, there was a lot more robocalls, and frankly, I think even polite Iowans tend to hang up on them a lot, which makes me doubt the accuracy of such polls. Second, I don't mind answering an anonymous poll, but when they track me by name, it freaks me out. Normally, I'm a good surveyor filler outer, but our household has opted out of answering any more poll questions because of that. I wonder how many other people have too. How do you react to that, Tom?
Well, I think that what both of these things are sort of reflective of is that it is getting harder and harder for pollsters to reach people than it's been in the past. A generation or two ago, people liked to answer polls, and polls would get a relatively high response rate. But in an era where people are getting so much unwanted communication on their phones, on their computers, et cetera, a lot of polls are getting less than 10% of people to respond to them, and frequently the people who do respond to polls aren't necessarily entirely representative of the population as a whole. For instance, whenever we go in and do a poll in Iowa, we'll have older voters answer disproportionately to younger voters. It's a lot easier to get an interview with somebody who's 65 than with someone who's 27.
And they're more likely to have a landline, correct?
And that as well. And increasingly a lot more polls are calling cell phones. Some still can't. Robo-polls like the ones we do, we're not even allowed to call cell phones. And even polls that do call cell phones, people are less likely to want to answer a poll if they're, say, out driving in their car or something and they have their cell phone on them. They're just not as likely to answer as they would if they had a landline at home. So these are some of the big challenges moving forward. And I think there's a bigger chance this year than there would usually be, and then there's been in the past two election cycles, of the polls being wrong in one direction or the other simply because it's getting so much harder to reach people.
Let's go to Medea before our hour is up. Medea joining us from Des Moines. Hi, Medea.
Hi there. I wanted to make an observation. I've participated in a number of polls, and there's never an option for independent or for a third-party candidate. And I think that that is a valid representation of part of our population.
Anne, would you react to that, please?
Yeah, when we ask the question for president, and I think for down the ballot as well, would you vote for Barack Obama? Would you vote for Mitt Romney? For somebody else? So there are about almost a dozen candidates who are going to be on the ballot, and we're not going to spend a lot of time naming all of those. But there is an option there. If you're voting for someone else, we can capture that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Medea, joining us from Des Moines. Iowa is on track to have a record number of people voting by absentee ballot, also many voting early at satellite voting stations. And how is this taken into account in polling? How does that, I suppose, complicate your challenge?
Well, up until the time that early voting starts, we have a standard question which asks, how likely are you to vote? Will you definitely vote, probably vote, might or might not vote, or probably not vote? And we just take the definitelys. Once early voting has started, we add another category to that, which is, or have you already voted? Mm-hmm. Because you're a definite voter. I mean, your vote is already locked in. We want to be sure that we catch it. And in 2008, there were 32% roughly in that realm of people who did early vote, either by absentee ballot or through a satellite location. And this year, if what we're seeing in the PPP polls is accurate, there's already been that much voting already. So we may see a much bigger number come Election Day, a much higher proportion of people who early voted than we've ever seen.
And Tom Jensen, I suppose when you're polling in various states, there are various states going to the polls with absentee ballots, early voting in many different ways, and you have to account for all of those.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The swing states that have already been voting are Iowa, obviously, Ohio, Nevada, and North Carolina. And in all four of those states, we're finding a very large lead for Barack Obama with folks who have voted early. So I think it's good news for him on several fronts. It suggests that there is still a lot of enthusiasm about his campaign because folks not only want to go vote for him, but they want to go out and do it as soon as possible. And then I think it's always just a little bit safer to have those votes in the bank ahead of time. Here in North Carolina, Obama built up a huge early vote lead in 2008, and then it rained on Election Day. And Mitt Romney won big on Election Day, but still came up 14,000 votes short. You always wonder with something like that if the weather had been nice on Election Day, if Romney would have actually won, but Obama already had those votes in the bank.
We hear that in terms of early versus Election Day voting, that Republicans tend to vote more of the time on Election Day, and the Democratic trend is early voting. That's correct, Tom?
Yeah, and I think what you're almost definitely going to see in Iowa and tends to happen is that Obama will win the early vote. Mitt Romney most likely will win on Election Day. It's just a question of which one of those margins will be larger.
Okay, the Election Day vote versus the early vote. Is that the way you see it, Anne?
It's exactly the way I see it. And I've been observing something that the Obama campaign has been doing that I also think might be interesting, which is they've been holding a lot of rallies on college campuses and setting up holding those rallies very near a satellite voting center so that they get the crowd revved up and then they say, let's go vote right now. Because younger people are less likely to engage in early voting and they're less likely to vote generally because Election Day comes around and maybe something else has popped up. They're not as committed a voting block as older age groups. So having that opportunity right there to lock in the votes that they've already got coming out to the rally, I think they're doing they're boosting their performance in early voting over 2008 is my expectation.
The hour getting away from us, and I don't want to talk to two pollsters without mentioning or getting your view on Nate Silver, the rock star of polling. He writes a very popular blog on polling for the New York Times. Tom Jensen, why is Nate Silver so popular? Is he doing something really unique here?
Well, I think what he does is there's 1,000 polls out there, and he sort of takes them and processes them in a way that people can maybe more easily understand than trying to look at 15 different polls on the same race and trying to figure out which ones are right and which ones are wrong. I think that that sort of helps people cut through the clutter. The other thing that I think has made him particularly a star this year is that he's still very confident that Barack Obama is going to get reelected, and that's provided a lot of reassurance to liberals as things have sort of fallen apart a little bit for the president over the last month. Because he's showing a lot more confidence than you would necessarily take from the face value of the poll. So, you know, I think what he does is great, and it's a big part of people's understanding of polls.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that, Anne? Nate Silver's work is something to console Obama fans
to some extent. Well, I don't know that they're feeling all that consoled just now. On October 1st, Nate Silver was showing Barack Obama having 320 electoral votes. You need 270 to win. And this morning, I think that was closer to 280, 285. So if you see something slipping like that, I don't know that you're going to characterize your mood mood is consoled. Mm-hmm. But what Nate Silver does that wonks like me and like Tom care about is he's transparent about his model and will explain it in great depth to the extent that you're interested in it. And when something changes, he will say, oh, here's something we didn't expect, and he will put out his explanation for why he thinks things happened and what adjustments they're going to make. And there's just not enough of that. There's just not enough transparency all the way around. So I'm a fan.
Okay, we have just a few seconds left. A quick answer from each of you. Is this the last election cycle in which we will say the debates don't matter that much?
Yes.
And what
quick
about,
answer.
Tom,
yes.
Tom, yes, your answer, Tom.
The first debate this month, I think, was the most influential debate in presidential history if Mitt Romney ends up winning.
Okay, we may be tracing it back to that landmark in that eventuality. In any case, it will be a landmark in this presidential election cycle. Tom Jensen, Director of Public Policy Polling, thank you for joining us from North Carolina.
Thank you.
And Ann Selzer, President of Selzer & Company, a public opinion research company based in Des Moines. Ann, thanks for coming into our studio.
My pleasure.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. And tomorrow on this program, the Midwest is being overrun by superhuman vampires, don't you know? Just in time for Halloween, we'll talk with Justin Cronin. He'll take us to his post-apocalyptic world he's created in his second book of the highly acclaimed Vampire Trilogy tomorrow on this program.